This is Eagle 1490 AM WLCX La Crosse and streaming everywhere on the Civic Media app.
ABC News, I'm Dave Packer. Russian President Vladimir Putin apologizing to Azerbaijan's leader, but stopping short of taking responsibility for the deadly crash of an Azerbaijan Airlines plane in Kazakhstan. Israeli troops storming one of Gaza's last hospitals Friday, forcing staff and patients out, says Gaza's health ministry. The Israeli military accusing Hamas of using the hospital for cover. New York Governor Kathy Hochul has ordered 14 correctional officers be fired after an inmate was beaten to death at a correctional facility near Syracuse. Former NYPD Chief of Department Jeffrey Madry accused of sexual misconduct. Lieutenant Katisha Ebbs accusing Madry of sexually assaulting her in exchange for $200,000 in overtime. But Madry's attorney, Lambros Lambro, says
Lieutenant Epps had a consensual adult relationship, albeit for a short time, with Jeff.
Lambro says his client never harmed anybody. This is ABC News. A U.S. Coast Guard search has not been able to find a 51-year-old man who fell overboard on a Norwegian Epic cruise ship on Thursday. The accident happened around 3 in the afternoon after about 30 miles. They were 30 miles east of Long Island in the Bahamas. A star of stage and screen has died.
Olivia Hussey, best known as Juliet in the 1968 film adaptation of Shakespeare's Romeo and Juliet, has died.
Oh, Romeo, Romeo.
Hussey was just 15 when she was picked for that role after the director saw her on stage in a production of The Prime of Miss Jean Brody. She earned a Golden Globe for Best New Actress for playing Juliet and went on to star in the horror film Black Christmas in 1974 and in the television series Jesus of Nazareth in 1977. Hussey was 73. Mike Dubusky, ABC News.
A single winner for last night's $1.22 billion Mega Millions jackpots. Tickets sold in a convenience store in California. Dave Packer, ABC News.
Uh-oh, Brad's buzzed.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, he's starting with the woots. And now a speech.
I just want to say that friendship is about heart. Heart and brain. Who's with me?
Good thing is, he knows when he's buzzed.
And my brain is saying, when it's time to go home, somebody call me a ride.
Love that guy.
Me too.
Know your buzzed warning signs? Call for a ride when it's time to go home. Buzz driving is drunk driving. A message from NHTSA and the Ad Council.
The Dom Salvia Show.
How about this one? Harvey K., a Delano Democrat.
The problem with that is that was his mother's family name. You might not realize that he had a father, too.
Come on, man.
Subscribe to my arguments, and you can call a Dom Democrat.
All right, I'll take a Dom Democrat. But Franklin Delano Roosevelt, a big favorite here on this show.
The Dom Salvia Show. Weekdays from 4 till 6 on the Civic Media Radio Network and on the Civic Media app. Your news, conversations, and a whole lot of fun. It's all on your local Civic Media radio station or the Civic Media app.
For Civic Media News, I'm Savannah Tome Olson. Congress has extended the 2018 Farm Bill while they continue to work on a new one, leaving Wisconsin farmers somewhat relieved but still worried. Judith Ruiz Branch reports.
One of the biggest problems cited with the current farm bill is that it was negotiated more than 5 years ago, so the crop reference prices are outdated. Paul Mitchell, agriculture and economics professor at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, explains the reference prices allow payments to farmers when a crop falls below a certain level.
Prices have been declining on the corn and soybeans, and the process is used to create this support in these times of thin negative margins. They're out of date. Those floors were set in 2018, and you know, we've gone through a lot of inflation, and so, you know, $1,000 isn't what it used to be.
Mitchell says farm organizations have been asking Congress to increase crop reference prices. The farm bill was extended again for another year as a part of a spending bill to avert a federal government shutdown. Mitchell says a lot of uncertainty looms with the incoming administration's goal to cut budget costs.
So my real worry is that agriculture will be collateral damage for the new administration as they pursue other political priorities where, you know, agriculture is not their number one priority. And they will take the cost of agricultural hurt to address these issues they want to address that would partly help them get elected.
Other areas of concern in the farm bill, he says, are crop insurance, conservation programs, and the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, or SNAP, which is still offering benefits too low to help those who need them, according to an Urban Institute report. For Wisconsin News Connection, I'm Judith Ruiz Branch. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
And this is Civic Media News. I'm Savannah Tomei Olson.
You can always continue the conversation on social media. Share your thoughts when you find and follow Civic Media on Facebook, X, and Instagram.
With your forecast, I'm Corey Hartman. For today, becoming mostly sunny, highs near 45 degrees. For tonight, mostly cloudy, we'll see a low around 30 degrees. For Sunday, mostly cloudy and a high near 41. Sunday night, clouds and 29. For Monday, partly sunny and highs near 40.
Currently, 42 degrees.
Dom Selvia.
Next time, what does former FBI and CIA Director William Webster have to say about Cash Patel and Tulsi Gabbard? Also, our favorite Delano Democrat, Harvey Kay, on the rise of homelessness and political exhaustion. Tune in.
The Dom Selvia Show, weekdays 4 till 6. This is the talk of La Crosse, Eagle 1490 AM.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
What is up? Oh my gosh. Welcome back. I hope you all had a wonderful holiday week. We got another one coming up here with the whole New Year thing. We have an awesome show today. If you want to hear last week's show, thank you again to Tammy Baldwin, and thank you so much to our dear friend Ahmad Rivera-Wagner for... I had like an hour or two notice that Tammy Baldwin was not going to join us for the whole show. So I really want to say thanks to Ahmad for coming in. I don't know if we hit on that, but if you want to hear that show, that was a lot of fun, and we talked about a lot of things. Civicmedia.us, every one of our episodes is available for podcast download, just like this one. And I've got a couple Johns here. Our dear friend of the show and my dear brother, John Becker, was in town because it's, you know, Christmas and stuff. And I thought it'd be awesome to have him guest host. So here he is.
Good afternoon, evening, morning, day, everyone. It's nice. It's a honor to be here with you. And I'm excited to experience it live behind the mic for the first time.
Hell yeah. We said that we could say that word. So I figured I'd pull it out here. So thank you for being here. And another John, Dr. John Shelton, he said I could call him John, so that's what we're going to do. He is the professor and chair of Democracy and Justice Studies at UWGB. He's also the vice president for higher education of the American Federation of Teachers here in Wisconsin. What's up, man?
Hey, how's it going? Happy holidays, everybody.
Yeah.
First of all, just watched Die Hard for the first time this week. It is definitely a Christmas movie.
Okay.
All right. Can we just deal with that at the outset?
I can agree with that. I can get down with that. That's a good movie. I watched it for the first time last year.
Okay.
Good. Because I was like, what is this all about? It's not bad.
It's good. No, yeah. It's very good. It's very good.
Yeah, I appreciate the hot take right off the bat.
You know, it's only, 33 years old or something? Yeah. But, you know.
Is it really? Is that
1989, yeah.
Oh, man.
Yeah, I remember 89. I'm old enough to remember it. Jeez. So what does that say?
We're not old. But so we're pulling out the big guns here today. It's really interesting. John Shelton wrote a piece that kind of stirred the drink a little bit, I think, so to speak. It was published in The Nation. We'll put the link on our socials and the website and all that kind of stuff. It was titled "Why Democrats Are Losing Americans Without a College Degree and How to Win Them Back." The idea was voters intuitively know that the economy has not worked well for most of them, or most of us, really, for decades. And Democrats must offer a transformative vision and stick to it as long as it takes. Oof.
Yeah. Yeah.
That is a gut check piece, my friend.
Small stuff. Small stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. Details.
Yeah. So, you know, I've been working on this question for years, actually, after the first Trump election, 2016, I kind of started thinking about, you know, how do we explain this? I think a lot of us were trying to figure that out. And one of the things that I noticed in that election was the huge chasm between Americans with college degrees and those without and how they voted. Mm. And so voters without college degrees went for Trump by substantial margin. Voters for Hillary Clinton voters with college degrees went for Hillary Clinton by a little bit of a smaller margin, but it was still substantial. And, you know, the thing that was really interesting was that white voters without college degrees went for Trump in huge margins. Now, at the time, you know, obviously there's a lot of racial politics involved in that. But, you know, what I started to do is I started writing this book and became friends with my co-author of The Nation piece, Neil Krause. We're both union presidents in Wisconsin, and we both think about this. He's got a great book out, too, called The Fantasy Economy. And, you know, started asking, like, what did it, like, why is that? Why is it that Americans without college degrees voted for Trump? And it's a complicated question. You know, I think one of the big things that I uncover in the book that I wrote called The Education Myth, which came out in 2023, is that Democrats didn't offer very much for people without college degrees, right? It was just basically like, go to college. NAFTA, I write a lot about NAFTA. You know, if we're going to negotiate these free trade deals that hurt blue collar livelihoods, well, you're just going to go back and get another degree or get retrained. Robert Reich, when he was the Secretary of Labor under Clinton, advocated hard for NAFTA, and then, like, you know, 20 years later was like, oops, my bad. Like that actually hurt a lot of workers. And, you know, states like Michigan, Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, the states that have swung elections for Trump, they've really been hit hardest by the sort of war on blue collar livelihoods. Now, here's what's interesting in the last 8 years is that minorities without college degrees, that was a huge part of the vote for Hillary Clinton in 2016. That gap that was like 50 points in 2016 has shrunk to less than 30. And it shrunk even in 2020 when Biden did predominantly better, you know, better comparatively with workers without college or with all voters, obviously, than in 2024 for Kamala Harris. And so, you know, something's going on here, right? Democrats, and, you know, like, I'm a Democrat. I have no problem saying that. I've been an active member of the party for years, ran for city council on an unapologetic, you know, as a Democrat this past spring. But, you know, we have to look at what it is that we're doing. And as a party, we're not offering enough of a transformative vision for voters without college degrees. And increasingly, this economy, as you noted, isn't working for those of us who have college degrees now, right? I mean, now, right. You know, it's just an economy that doesn't work for most working people. And so, you know, I think the good news is, you know, you could basically say, well, you know, Trump has won two of the last three elections, so he must be this incredibly popular politician. No, he's not a popular politician. Not at all. Yeah. What's happening is Americans, especially those like 10 million Americans that swing elections, are desperately voting for something to change. And as Democrats, we can do that, but we have to have the right vision and we have to offer something that's going to improve the economic livelihoods of all Americans.
So, like, how do you sell that?
Yeah.
Well, first of all, what is the vision? Do you have could you sketch out for folks what the transformative vision is that you propose?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. And so I get to it in the book. So folks can check out the book because I'm pretty you know, like, a lot of these books sort of diagnose what the problem is and don't offer what they think we should do about it. I'm very much like, here's what we should do about it. Yeah. Here's why I'm writing a book. We need a bold vision that's built around the idea of economic rights for all Americans. The idea that people should have the right to a job, the right to health care, the right to housing, all those things that are poll at incredibly high levels. I mean, when you know, labor unions, I mean, almost the majority of Republicans support labor unions right now.
Yeah.
You know, universal health care, when you frame it the right way, a vast majority of Americans support that. And so if we push for those things, and the good news about this is, like, we don't have to, you know, come up with all this from scratch. You know, like, Democrats have done this in the past. FDR, I opened my book with this, actually. FDR talks about an economic bill of rights, advocated an economic bill of rights in the 1940s. This was coming on the heels of the New Deal. And this wasn't like a theoretical thing. He was saying, no, Americans deserve these things. And so there's been different, you know, different iterations of this out there now. My good friend Harvey Kaye and Alan Minsky have proposed an economic bill of rights for the 21st century that I think is quite good. That's what we actually need. We need working Americans to see what it is that they deserve and that a party's actually fighting for those things and fighting with them, right? So we talk about in the piece that, like, Democrats need to work much more closely with labor unions and build the labor movement to get these things. And to your point, Mark, I mean, you know, like, we don't have to sell these things. This isn't a sales job, right? I mean, this is building something together. And so it's going to take, you know, I think Neil and I conclude the piece by basically saying there's not one weird trick, right? I mean, like, we have to do this over a sustained amount of time. But again, look at the 1930s. You know, Democrats were able to realign American politics actually more rapidly than maybe more people would have thought. And I think we could do that now if we mobilize around the right vision. I really do believe that.
So, you know, because I mean, at the end of the day, the salespeople are the politicians. They have to do that. And one of the things that I think is really difficult about, you know, Trumpism, and I've talked about this a lot on my show, that he's a stupid person, you know, like
profoundly.
The challenge is going to be when he's no longer running, we're not going to have someone that's a bumbling idiot. There's going to be someone on the other side that is a smooth talker that can. And so how Trump really won this election, we saw that here in Wisconsin, where it was those ads that, you know, had nothing to do with the economic situation of the country. It had nothing to do with that. What it said was it took a class of people and divided it. It was Kamala Harris is for they, them. Donald Trump is for you.
Yep.
Right. Nothing to do with my eggs are too expensive, you know? And so one of the things that I've noticed, and I don't know the answer to this, is how do we take a profoundly, you know, challenging question and talk to people with, you know, with that integrity and hit them where right between the eyes and make it make sense. And so they're not on the, you know, Kamala Harris is for they, them. And then we're not talking to those people, but it's the people in the middle that do see that. And they're like, oh boy, you know, we have to sell it somehow.
And the right has done a stunningly, tragically successful job over the years and decades of weaponizing culture war issues in order to, you know, convince white working class folks to vote against their own interests. So I think that's an important question to examine and to think about is how do we combat that with you know, that the culture war divisiveness with this positive vision going forward that, as you were saying, John, surveys over and over again show that the overwhelming majority of voters do support these common sense, economic justice, forward facing policies.
Yeah. Although one thing I would also illustrate or underscore is it's not just white working class voters that are going for Trump. I mean, this is the first time since reliable exit polling has existed that people in the lowest income bracket voted for Republican.
Why? I don't understand that.
Well, I'm going to explain that.
All right. Yeah.
So first of all, I actually don't agree that Trump is an incredibly stupid person. He's stupid in some ways, but in terms of being able to mobilize people's grievances, he's actually quite good at that.
Yeah.
What Trump is, he's a sociopath. Right.
Yes.
And so what he's able to do is throw things out there and whatever sticks.
Yeah.
He's able to then just say because if you have no morals, you'll just say anything. Right. And so these things that get rises at crowds, he just keeps saying them. And so I look at Republicans like I look at the weather. OK, in this country. Right. Like their goal as a party is to enable capital as much as they can, to take away workers' rights, to set people against each other. You're absolutely right about that, Mark. And when they vote against, when they vote, and when Americans vote for Republicans in an election like this, it's more that they're voting against Democrats. Mm-hmm. It's not that they're voting for Republicans.
Right.
And so, you know, I think that the issue is that, you know, and I know we've got to go to break soon, but like for like 50 years, Democrats have moved further and further away from doing things that will actually just prioritize the economic security of working people, right? But they focused on education, which I'm an educator, I'm not anti-education, but at the expense of things like jobs guarantees, healthcare, all these things, and we can get back into it, but like you have to have that sort of like big vision for how we're going to change things and stick to it over a long period.
Yeah, stick with us here at on the other side of the break. I've got Professor John Shelton, my brother John Becker, and I'm Mark here on the Rational Revolution. We'll be right back.
You're listening to The Eagle, WLCX, Lacrosse's home for Nightlight with Pete Schwabba.
I'm Dan Schaefer. Let's recombobulate. As 2024 comes to a close, we're taking our annual look back at the year that was, recapping our most read, most listened to, and most impactful stories of the year. If you're new to learning about the recombobulation area, this would be a great place to start to see what we're all about. This year, we covered the RNC in Milwaukee and the DNC in Chicago and broke stories that made national news along the way. We wrote about the fight for fair maps and covered elections in the state legislature like no one else. I wrote opinion columns and feature stories and conducted extended sit-down interviews like one with Senator Tammy Baldwin. I hosted podcasts and radio shows, and of course, joined the Civic Media Network, where you've heard me all over the airwaves for the last few months. This last year was discombobulating at times, but we did our best to make sense of it all, and we've got a whole lot more recombobulation in store for the year ahead in 2025.
Find all of Dan's work at the Recombobulation Area and on our website at civicmedia.us. You're listening to the Talk of La Crosse, Eagle 1490 AM.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
You can feel his disease. Come together right now.
Oh. Welcome back. Rational Revolution here. I'm Mark Becker. We've got my brother John as a co-host. And we've got John Shelton, who's a professor and chair of Democracy and Justice Studies at UWGB, vice president for higher education at the American Federation of Teachers here, and all around good guy. We were talking at the other end of the break about Donald Trump not being a stupid person in all respects, but I kind of equivalent, like say what he does is like Phil Spector's wall of sound. Everything just hits you. Some things stick and some goes right past, but that's kind of what you were alluding to.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And, you know, there's like a feedback loop, right? I mean, because if you don't have any morals and you're just, and Trump does not have any morals,
no.
Right? I mean, like, you just throw everything out there and you'll literally say anything that you think will get you votes, then you do that. And the stuff that sticks, you just repeat those again, right? I mean, so in that way, he's kind of like a, you know, he's like a savant. I mean, I actually think that the bigger issue for the Republican Party is what happens after you don't have anybody with his singular level of just amorality. I mean, you know.
And shamelessness.
I mean, who's the dude from Florida?
DeSantis.
Yes. I mean, DeSantis tried to do that and tried to out Trump. And it was just like, nope, like you're a copy of this. Like, and people didn't buy it. And he fell flat on his face. J.D. Vance tried it to a certain extent. I mean, like, so you know, these people, they can't actually do it. So it'll be interesting to see what happens. I mean, ostensibly, Trump's not going to be around forever. So what does that look like when he's not?
Yeah, I say that here all the time about I worry about that because you're not going to have someone who is a bumbling idiot. But, you know, you're going to have someone who is very strategic about that. And, you know, they'll shoot with a sniper instead of a shotgun and that wall of sound. And so they'll be able to have they'll listen to the experts that say, hey, don't do that. Do it this way. And it will be refined and all of that kind of stuff. But I'm nervous too about how, you know, over these next 4 years, Donald Trump made a lot of mistakes, you know, in his first administration. He says, well, I'm going to have the best and the brightest. And I mean, you know, love him or hate him, you know, Rex Tillerson is an incredibly successful person. You know, Mattis is a very smart guy, but they turned on him. So now he's not going to have people in his administration that are, big thinkers and all that. He's going to have people that will shake their head up and down and do whatever he wants.
And sabotage federal agencies in the process.
Right. It's not. It's so, yep. You know, what damage can be done over the next 4 years? And hopefully, you know, we get some good people here and it's really only 2 years worth of damage and we can stop him. But what is he going to do in the meantime?
Oh, no question. I mean, don't take anything that I have said to say that, you know, we don't face drastic things happening in the next couple of years. Right. I mean, like we are facing that down. It's Project 2025, right? I mean, like whatever Trump said to disavow that, I mean, that will be the playbook. I mean, he listened to the Heritage Foundation in packing the Supreme Court. You know, I mean, there are going to be a lot of things that are going to be on the chopping block in the federal administration. I mean, I don't think he'll actually be able to, like, say, eliminate the Department of Education.
Right.
But there's a lot that you can do to, you know, completely weaken the things that the Department of Education does, for example. Right. I mean, so, yeah, I mean, this I think will be, if you want to think of it this way, a more effective version of Trumpism for sure.
Right.
I also think, you know, we're more organized this time around on our side.
Yeah.
And, you know, hopefully this is a wake up call and, you know, we all think about exactly what to run on in 2 years because the Republicans are not going to actually deliver anything for working.
No,
they will not. That's the one thing I can tell you that won't happen.
No.
And so
they're going to pretend like they did.
Yeah. But did that work for them in 2020?
No.
I mean, again, like look at the last, look at the last like 10 years of elections and what's happened. People are saying we are going to vote for whoever's not in power in order to get something to change. Or we want things to change. That's what people are saying. And so like when you, I've heard some pretty, I can say ass, right? Some half-assed critiques. I was trying to remember what swears I could say. Some half-assed critiques of like what happened in this election. It's like, well, gas prices were too high or price of eggs, right? You noted. And that stuff that's true, but it's more that, you know, when you look at what's happened to workers in this country, and that's not just now workers without college degrees, because now you have people with college degrees. A lot of my students, they come out with, you know, $10,000, $20,000 worth of debt, and they're working as a barista in Starbucks, which great. Yeah. Work as a barista in Starbucks, organize your union there, right? I mean, like that's great. But the problem is that for half of this country, we're living paycheck to paycheck. And workers' wages, when you adjust for inflation adjust for productivity, have declined since the 1970s.
Yeah.
The only reason that workers' standards of living have kept anywhere close to where they were like 50 years ago is because A, you have more two-parent working families, and B, because of credit, right? Everybody is deeply indentured to all this, you know, consumer credit in this country.
I hate any critique of this election other than Kamala Harris had an impossible task of 104 days to do anything. You know what I mean? And it, like, there's so much backstory with, you know, Joe Biden and
he didn't do us any favors.
He didn't.
Correct.
And Kamala Harris, I do believe, was the right candidate at the right time. She didn't have any time to make that case.
I think that's right. And the other thing that was a problem is, and by the way, like, I think Biden was probably the best president we've had since at least the 1960s. I mean, he's moving.
History will be very kind to him.
He's definitely moving away from some of the neoliberal policies that Democrats have been pushing for around free trade and busting unions and all these kinds of things. It just wasn't fast enough, and they did not take nearly enough credit for it. And then I felt like Harris was kind of confused about, do I stand on some of these things? Do I not stand on them? How do I differentiate myself?
And there's no time to like pull things and do communications and see, okay, well, maybe we shouldn't say it this way. They had no time to do any of that.
And I think primaries are really good for the party in presidential elections so that we can have some of these conversations and, you know, as a party, and let the candidates see what they want to actually run on and what's going to resonate with people. And Biden deprived us of that. I mean, I think he was a great president in many ways, but I would have much preferred to have an open primary where people could have made their case.
Yeah. How, you know, and this is a big question for a minute left in the segment, but like, how do you can't say the same thing in Northeast Wisconsin than you do in Massachusetts or DC or all of that kind of stuff. So, you know, while the $15 an hour minimum wage is a good thing, but you look at what Rebecca Cook did in the sixth of, you know, the western part of the state, and she ran on, hey, we need to have solid and strong borders. We need to not spend more than we have, but no one should tell me what I should do with my own body, and gay people should be able to get married without being, you know what I mean? So how do you be that purple blue and still be able to be progressive enough to keep this vision of yours?
I got like 30 seconds to answer.
You did. But that we can tee this up. But this will be our teaser here.
Yeah.
Because I think that is such a huge question that needs to be answered. And that's something that I've, you know, in my time in the Republican Party, they tried to do this when Mitt Romney was running. And I tried to say everything that I could is, we can't do that. We cannot take this vision and blanket it all across the country, because that's the beautiful thing about this country. We are so diverse in our opinions and all of that. And we're going to pick up that answer on the other end of the break here.
Right,
the Rational Revolution. We'll be back.
You're listening to The Eagle, WLCX, La Crosse's home for the Todd Allball Show.
ABC News, I'm Dave Packer. Russian President Vladimir Putin apologizing to Azerbaijan's leader, but stopping short of taking responsibility for the deadly crash of an Azerbaijan Airlines plane in Kazakhstan. Israeli troops storming one of Gaza's last hospitals Friday, forcing staff and patients out, says Gaza's health ministry. The Israeli military accusing Hamas of using the hospital for cover. New York Governor Kathy Hochul has ordered 14 correctional officers be fired after an inmate was beaten to death at a correctional facility near Syracuse. Former NYPD Chief of Department Jeffrey Madry accused of sexual misconduct. Lieutenant Katisha Ebbs accusing Madry of sexually assaulting her in exchange for $200,000 in overtime. But Madry's attorney, Lambros Lambro, says
Lieutenant Ebbs had a consensual adult relationship, albeit for a short time, with Jeff.
Lambro says his client never harmed anybody. This is ABC News.
Enjoying this local program? Find the complete Civic Media lineup at civicmedia.us or the Civic Media app.
Badgers hockey in Milwaukee. Hi, I'm Mike Clemens with sports. Men's college hockey, it's the Wisconsin Badgers against Ferris State tonight at Five Serve Forum. It's part of the holiday face-off tournament going on this weekend. The Badgers hope to improve their record of 7-10-1. NFL, the Packers face the Vikings in Minnesota. 3:25 tomorrow, Vikings star wide receiver Justin Jefferson.
Just going against Green Bay, you know, everybody know we hate them and they hate us. The fans know just the whole rivalry in general is something to get juiced up about. So I definitely rank this one high.
Packers quarterback Jordan Love.
I mean, all the motivation is right there. It's division opponent. Obviously, they beat us first game. So we're going into their place. And, we want to get some of that revenge that we're looking for. So we're trying to go down there and handle business in the NFC North, which we've dropped a couple games already this year. So we need to go get a win.
That's Jordan Love with sports. I'm Mike Clemens.
This is your local Civic Media radio station. Want to hear even more? Anytime? Find all of it at civicmedia.us.
With your forecast, I'm Corey Hartman. For today, becoming mostly sunny. Highs near 45 degrees. For tonight, mostly cloudy. We'll see a low around 30 degrees. For Sunday, mostly cloudy and a high near 41. Sunday night, clouds and 29. For Monday, partly sunny and highs near 40.
Currently, 42 degrees.
You're listening to the American Democracy Minute, keeping your government by and for the people. A 2023 decision in an Arkansas redistricting case found individual voters did not have a private right of action to challenge the maps. The state of Louisiana tried the same tactic in its chaotic gerrymandering case, but was refused on June 24th. Be looking for another challenge in 2025. Defying precedent, the Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals held in a 2023 Arkansas racial gerrymandering case that individual voters do not have a private right of action under the VRA Section 2. It said only the U.S. Justice Department could bring such cases, despite individuals having filed 90% of previous challenges. Calling it radical, scholars expected it to be quickly overturned, but this January, the full Eighth Circuit refused to rehear the case. Seeing an opening, Louisiana asked the full Fifth Circuit to rehear its gerrymandering case on the same grounds, with 13 other Republican attorneys general urging a no private right of action decision. In a close vote Monday, the Fifth Circuit refused that rehearing. For now, the Eighth Circuit decision still only affects Arkansas, Iowa, Minnesota, Missouri, Nebraska, North Dakota, and South Dakota. But it's clear that private right of action is the new battleground and will almost certainly reach the U.S. Supreme Court. We've linked to more on the private right of action at AmericanDemocracyMinute.org. I'm Brian Beal.
The Maggie Dawn Show.
Cindy from Appleton.
Time Magazine has made the convicted felon the man of the year this year. Shame on them.
Time Magazine base their person of the year on impact and like newsmaking. The CEO assassination is pretty much the only news cycle that isn't entirely focused on Donald Trump, and yet it still relates to him because he has no health care policy.
The Maggie Dawn Show. Weekdays from 2 till 4 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the Civic Media app. Pete Schwabba.
On the next Nightlight, I welcome Appleton-based comedian John Egan into the studio. Then Chicago comedians Bill Gorgo and Jim McHugh join the show to promote a New Year's Eve extravaganza in Port Washington. Let's light it up.
Weeknights from 6 till 8.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
Welcome back. So I opened my big mouth and I was asking a big question right before the break. You know, I'm still a rookie at this. You know, it's but I think we're almost to my 1 year thing doing this whole. We're pretty close. Anyway, so I was asking John Shelton here, who's a professor at UWGB, and with my brother John Becker. How do we take these ideas that do make sense and share them across the fruited plains while still trying to, because what we have to do is get those people that are in the middle.
Yeah. Look,
okay. I think Wisconsin showed that.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So look, here's the thing. Elections are very complicated. People vote on along a number of different dimensions, right? But I think that my big argument is that we need to focus on economic security more, right? And that doesn't have to be the only thing that we focus on. We need to focus on it. We need to have a narrative around it. And I think sometimes we have these ideas. You're referencing purple, you know, ideas. Economic security is a purple idea. It's actually something that even people who vote Republican can get behind. And I'll give you a good example of that. You know, I mentioned before that I ran for city council, and I ran against Bill Galvin, four-time incumbent. Bill's a great guy. I think we had a very good election.
That was cool.
I lost by 43 votes.
Oh, okay? Wow.
Against a four-time incumbent.
That's impressive.
I had no business doing that well. And the reason I did is because I knocked a lot of doors and I talked to people about what they cared about. And you know, one of the number one thing that I heard, right? I had a few different things that I kind of was talking about that were important to me. By the end of the campaign, the only thing I was talking about was housing, because that was what resonated with people. And my district is very diverse in terms of race and socioeconomic status. But across the board, you know, there were people who had adult children living with them because they couldn't afford housing. There were military vets. I stopped and you know, one day, shouldn't admit this on air, but whatever. I had a smoke with a military vet who like couldn't afford to stay in his apartment. Mm. And he was like, "You're the first person who I've ever talked to who like actually talked about this issue of housing and like affordable housing in a way that actually made sense to me." And one of the things I was talking about was why it is that people don't have good housing. And it's not because that housing is like the weather. It's because corporations in this country, investment companies, are buying up properties and either jacking up the rents or just keeping them unavailable. In Green Bay, for example, like Airbnb companies that are buying properties and using them for Airbnbs. And so like you can talk about those things and those things resonate with people if you do it in the right way and you don't lecture them about why they didn't go and get the right college degree, right? Mm-hmm. Or like the things they've done wrong to be in a deeply unfair economy. And so like with Rebecca Cook, I mean, she came very close to winning. Katrina Shanklin, who ran against her, was a good friend of mine, so I was supporting her in the primary. But I would have liked to have seen Rebecca Cook actually do more to push for big economic security issues, right? I mean, like, you can be big on these things, and they resonate with people. You just look at polling. When you talk about things like guaranteeing people the right to a job and housing and doing something about for-profit healthcare that takes advantage of people, all these things poll really well. We just don't talk about them the right way. We don't talk about them in a way that resonate with voters. We've got to do more of that.
One of the questions that's popped into my head as I've been reading your piece and in our conversation is you know, I think about the just incredible asymmetry between the right and the left in this country in terms of how the right, they have spent decades and decades. They play the long game better than anyone on everything from building up an entire media echo chamber ecosystem to amplify lies and disinformation and spin.
Absolutely.
They've invested in think tanks to, quote unquote, think tanks to advance their policies. They have attacked public education and sort of it mounted up their own schools, their own private colleges to funnel folks. They have an entire infrastructure in place to attack and undermine these sort of common sense progressive ideals and policies that the majority of Americans support. How do you know? And whereas the left so often we get into our circular firing squad mode, and like you said, it's attacking folks for not doing the right thing or imposing our purity litmus tests and things like that. How do you have any thoughts about how like the left might be able to be more effective in counteracting that? Because I really do think that we need to build some kind of infrastructure to if we're ever going to get through to people with these common sense policies and break the stranglehold. How do we do that when we're up against such a behemoth?
It's a great question. I would say two things. I mean, one, you know, the right has these infrastructures, and what they can put into them is money, right? I mean, that's the advantage that the right has. But we have these infrastructures already. They're called unions, right? I mean, like institutions that can bring people together around economic interests. The biggest, aside from being home, right, the place that most Americans spend the most part of their day, we're vastly the most overworked industrial nation in this world, is at work. Absolutely. And so when we join together around a common narrative and common explanation for what it is that is actually making our economy and our world to be unfair, then we can build that infrastructure quite rapidly, actually. And so, like, so that's number one. Number two is, and this is, and I'm not talking about like Democrats in Green Bay. I'm talking about here, Democrats nationally. We have to stop trying to like out corporate America, the Republicans, right? Like, as Neil and I wrote very explicitly in the piece, Americans can either continue to accommodate corporate America or they can win elections, but they can't do both, because the right is always going to do a better job of that than us. And so, like, you know, I think that doesn't mean that you have to like be anti-business and everything that you say, but like, you know, when Kamala Harris came to Green Bay, she talked a lot about small business. Small businesses are fine. They're great. Most people don't work in small businesses. They have a boss. They have a boss who exploits them and makes them, you know, work crazy hours and you know, doesn't pay into their retirement benefits, right? Or like Starbucks, when you've had 500 Starbucks companies or retail outlets that have voted to unionize, they drag their feet and don't actually negotiate with them. I mean, these are the people doing all of the actual work that makes Starbucks profitable, and the corporation is like, no, we're just not going to do it. So Democrats have to like take the side of the working people, right? They have to do that. And that's actually in the long run how you're going to change things.
Well, I think, you know, being a small business person, I think small business and working, we're pretty much the same. I mean, yeah. I don't
work your ass off.
Yeah. I don't make more than I did when I worked for someone. But the difference is, you know, I tell my employees, don't work over 40 hours a week, be home with your family. I give them the best health insurance plan that we possibly can. I pay more than any other company would. I do these things because I know that if I treat my employees right, I'm going to get the best and the brightest people to come here. And as long as they're treated right, treated fairly and paid well, I don't, you know, we'll be fine.
We need more small business owners like you, brother.
Right. Well, but like, you know, talking to the working person and talking to a small business owner really can be the same thing. It's the same conversation, you know?
Yeah, no, 100%. But my only point is that Kamala made a big point of coming here and like emphasizing small business.
Right, you know? Right. Yeah, well, and it's such a tough thing to know where to go with this. You know what I mean? What's going to win? Because you can't govern if you can't win.
That's right. Right.
Nancy
Pelosi says, just win, baby.
Okay. let me ask you this, though. I'm going to ask you seriously.
Yeah.
If you said that Democrats nationally, what is our three-sentence explanation for what we do as a party?
What would I say? A three-sentence?
Yeah.
Mine?
Yeah.
I would say we empower people by doing the right thing and treating people with equity and justice. That's really what it is. I mean, it's what this show is. It's not left versus right. It's right versus wrong.
Yeah.
And Democrats are more right than they are wrong.
Building opportunities for all Americans, including marginalized Americans.
I think my point is that the right has had that down.
Yes.
For such a long time, right? We're gonna lower taxes. We're gonna get government off your back, and bring Christianity into more these moral values, right? Like. And so
goes back to the how do you sell it piece.
And so I think what I'm saying is that all the stuff you're saying is true, Mark. That's why I'm a Democrat. I'm a proud Democrat, right? But we need to have a very, very clear narrative and message. And again, stick to it, right? That connects to our history as Democrats, right? Like, are we Bill Clinton?
Right.
Who, you know, again, like told Republicans that he would make sure that they got reelected if they supported NAFTA? Or are we FDR? who, as we wrote in the piece, you know, who had a mill worker write to him and say, we finally have a man in the White House who understands my boss is a son of a right?
But then I think, you know, you look at some of the other issues, and it's looking here in Wisconsin, and you wrote another piece about Act 10 and how, you know, how horrific that was for public schools. People have no idea how damaging that and their, you know, the school choice and vouchers and all
especially
of
that. Especially in rural areas.
Oh, my God. Yes. Where I am in Pulaski, we are crushed here in Green Bay. They are crushed by that. You see tens of millions of dollars coming out of Green Bay Public Schools budget. And then the public gets pissed because, you know, hey, we need help.
There's a reason that, and there's a reason that Walker went for that first.
Right.
When they got into power.
Oh my God. Yeah, you were there.
Driving. I was just finishing up grad school in Milwaukee and driving back and forth between Milwaukee and Madison, banging on drums at the Capitol during the occupation and things like that. Like, there is a reason that he wanted to break the backs of teachers' unions first.
And then, but then in Wisconsin, he was seen as this, like, martyr figure and you know, or not martyr, but like this hero.
Shaking things up.
That was his catapult to run for president. How do we talk to people in Wisconsin and say that was a really BS idea?
So first of all, Walker lost, right? I mean, like, and I think a big part of the reason that Evers won in 2018 and won again, and you know, we've got Jill Enderle as state superintendent of education, is because enough people in the state do recognize how bad Republicans have been for public schools, right? And, you know, the real silver lining in this last election is look at how Democrats did in the legislature. I mean, our legislature is going to be much more accountable around public education issues. So I think number one, we're already doing it. I mean, you know, Democrats in this state, in my view, have done a much better job than they have nationally.
Yeah, I agree.
You've mentioned Ahmad. Ahmad's a great example of that. Yeah. I mean, the way he's able to talk about working class issues in a way that, like, resonates with people here, it's amazing. And so I think we are winning. And, you know, our state was the state that came closest, you know, within dramatically, huge headwinds that came closest to electing Kamala Harris. So I think in terms of the, you know, swing states and so, like, what was the margin? Like 50,000?
It was under 1%.
Right. So, like, I think we are doing it here. I think we need to keep doing it, but I think we're doing it. And I mean, Green Bay is a great example of that. I mean, look at Mayor Genrich, how when he came out and really identified strongly as a Democrat in 2023, he won that election handily in the face of everything that they threw at him. So, you know, I think we're doing it in Wisconsin. We just need to do more of it.
Well, and that ties in with another thing I wanted to ask about, which is that at this moment, you know, after in the aftermath of the 2024 election, I think a lot of Democrats and progressives, both locally and nationally, are sort of feeling out in the wilderness right now. There's a lot of, you know, everybody has, like you were saying earlier, their hot take about, you know, why the election went the way it did and things like that. But I think a lot of folks are feeling despondent. You know, I saw somebody the other day writing on social media about how it feels like there's an earthquake and we're waiting for that. That's happened and we're waiting for the tsunami, that comes afterwards. So a lot of folks are feeling despondent and not sure what to do as we face the specter of this next term. What advice do you have? What thoughts do you have for folks who want to know what they can do to help?
All right, so here's the first thing, okay? This is not the first time Americans have faced dark times. I mean, imagine being Frederick Douglass in the 1850s and wondering, is slavery ever going to be over? And pushing, the Union Army, pushing Lincoln to say, like, we're going to make this about ending slavery. Imagine Americans in the 1930s with the Great Depression and coming out of that much stronger and freer and a more democratic country. And then imagine those civil rights protesters in Selma in 1965 about to cross that bridge, knowing that there were white supremacists on the other side about to kick their heads in. I mean, that's literally what they knew was going to happen. Mm-hmm. If those people in those instances can fight for what it really means to be an American, like, we can do that too. And what it means to be an American is to fight to make your country freer and more democratic and fairer. And that's what it means to be true Americans. And that's what we're going to fight for.
I love that. We're not going to drop the torch that the past generations have handed on us.
Absolutely not. Absolutely not.
Yeah. And that's a big weight on our shoulders. Really. John Shelton, John Becker, thank you so much for joining us on the show. That was awesome.
Thanks for having me. It was great to be with you.
Yeah, we got to do that again.
A lot of fun. Happy holidays. Happy New Year, everybody.
Yeah, yes. Thank you. We'll be back with my thoughts here shortly.
Eagle 1490 AM.
Are you prepared for an emergency or disaster? Because it's not a matter of if, but when. Don't find yourself saying,
when the storm rolls in, my time to find a pet-friendly evacuation center will have run out.
The scorching heat wave will leave me powerless to cool my insulin.
I'll face a hurricane without meds. Now that's a tough pill to swallow.
Let's prepare so we all have a better story to tell. Get started at ready.gov/olderadults. Brought to you by FEMA and the Ad Council.
Earl Ingram.
Chuck from East Troy. Good morning to you, Chuck. You say what?
I have a bone to pick with you. Since my wife discovered Civic Media 2 years ago, we are addicted to Civic Media, and you are one of the ringleaders. So anyway, I just want to thank you. Have a good day.
Hey, Chuck, man, thank you very much for the call. Tell your wife I said thank you, and it's an honor and a privilege.
The Earl Ingram Show, weekday mornings 8 to 10 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the app.
You're listening to The Eagle, WLCX, Lacrosse's home for Up North News Radio.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
Welcome back, revolutionaries. Hello. Thank you so much for listening. I hope you guys had a wonderful Christmas and holiday season. We've got Kwanzaa. It's, you know, Hanukkah, all this stuff. It's such a wonderful time of the year, and you know, it's great to be able to talk to you guys after that. And I hope everything was great, and you got to see your families, and everything was wonderful. Also, a huge thanks to John Shelton. I'm still a rookie at this, and I want to give him the respect that he deserves and all of that. And, you know, professor, chair of democracy studies at UWGB, vice president for higher education. And it sounds like he said he's running for president. He said that publicly, so I can say that too. He's awesome, and he'll be back. And thank you again to my dear brother John, and it's good to have him on the show as well. It's such a big topic. You know, and we spend so much time on that topic here on this show, is why did that happen? What happened? How can we avoid that happening again? And it's, everybody's got an opinion, you know, and it was so cool to hear John Shelton's and read his article. And I do recommend you take some time and read that, because it's really insightful. And, you know, I think that it makes a lot of sense. And I'll take a little bit of an issue. He said, oh, you know, we're not salesmen, but we have to be. And I think he would probably agree to that, because, you know, I mean, at the end of the day, Donald Trump won because he was a really good salesman. He's an idiot, but he's a good salesman. And it's so hard. You know, we talk about being rational and talking about these issues that do affect people. And it's hard to have a rational argument when one in five Republicans think that Taylor Swift is a political operative, or 80% of them think that Joe Biden was behind Trump's Manhattan prosecution. You know, it was Joe Biden fueled that. No, nearly 7 of 10 think that he won the 2020 election. You know, over half Republicans think that January 6th was an Antifa-inspired attack. Half of them think that Donald Trump's classified documents that he had at Mar-a-Lago were planted. How do you have a rational discussion when people live every day in a world that is so irrational, right? And so to talk to them about something like, hey, maybe people should be paid more. Maybe $7.25 an hour is ridiculous. Maybe, you know, the audacity of your gash your head on a table and the first thought in your mind is, what's my deductible, instead of I need to go to the hospital. You know, like, these are, how do you have that discussion with people that are not living in reality, you know? And it's awesome to have these deep discussions about where we are politically and what Democrats need to do in order to win and what is right versus wrong. I mean, we talk about that all the time. This is not a left or right thing. This is right versus wrong. And these are healthy discussions. They have to happen. I think we have to be in a place where we're hearing ideas not from someone way far on the left, but someone that is more in the middle. I just joined the Democratic Party, by the way, last week. So that was a big deal for me. I have not done that since. So now, holy balls, here we go. But I think that right now the Democratic Party is in the same place that the Republican Party was in 2012. And I know because I was there. It's funny. I was the chairman of the party at that time. And I, on election night in 2012, and Mitt Romney was running against Barack Obama. And I was asked to speak at the victory party. And I was on my way to do election night panel for Fox 11, local station here in town. And so I did the whole hoorah up on stage and talking about how this is going to be a great night for Republicans, knowing full well Mitt's going to get his clock cleaned. You know, it's going to be great. And we're here to support Mitt Romney. We're here to support blah, blah, blah. And literally the second I got off stage, they called Wisconsin for Obama. And I was like, well, all right. So that there's that. So, but after that happened, the Republicans did their well-publicized, everybody knows they did the that autopsy of what do we do? How do we move forward? And what they did was they picked a guy from Wisconsin that knows a little bit about winning elections and said, hey, you run the damn thing. And for better or for worse, I think it's a lot for worse, you see how the Republican Party was able to thrive when Reince Priebus took it over. They delivered some huge victories. And the Democrats need to do that now, too. There is one guy that can fix this darn thing, and his name is Ben Wickler. He is the person that can turn the ship around and deliver some massive, massive wins. Because I do believe that the blowback from these next 2 years is going to be seismic. I think that the Democrats, as long as we do the right things, they can have huge gains. Because as John Shelton and John Becker said, Donald Trump is wildly unpopular. He's never won the popular. He didn't win it this time. And we have to do the right thing to win first. And I do believe that Ben Wickler understands that. He is the person that is best positioned to take the Democratic Party and bring them to new heights. I think that he understands that candidates have to have a little bit of a leash, because you cannot sell the same things in Wisconsin that you do in Washington State or California or Texas, right? That's why you look at what Rebecca Cook did, and she was brilliant. She did the right things. Hey, she was in a district that was like 8 to 10 points down, and she came within the margin of error. Like, that is huge. I don't know if she would have gotten more liberal. Would she have had more success? I don't necessarily think that's the case. But what I do think is, in 2 years, if she runs again, man, she could win that thing. I think that if we have the right candidate here in the 8th Congressional District, we have a guy that tied himself so tightly to Donald Trump, that's in play. I think that we could talk about someone who's wildly unpopular, you know, Glenn Grothman. Well, he sucks. We could do something about that. And Ben Wickler is someone who understands, hey, these people need resources, need help, and they need a leash to be able to win. They need some of that. Ben's the guy. I agree with Dr. Shelton. We do need to look inward. We have to look at where we are now. We got to figure it out. But I'm a huge believer in the idea that you cannot take this one solution and sell it all across the country the same way you do in every one of these, you know, different places. And we have to be able to have those big discussions in rooms full of people that are way far on the left and also in the middle, because that's how we reach them. I do think the Democratic Party has a winning message, just like John Shelton said. I agree 100%, but we have to win first. That's the big goal. And I think we will. Oh boy, it's going to be interesting. There's a lot more that we're going to unpack. And I'm so glad that you're going to be with us on this journey, because I do think that these conversations make all of the difference. So until next week, thank you so much for hanging out with us. On behalf of John Shelton, John Becker, and hey, me, Mark Becker, thank you for listening, and we'll see you next week here on The Rational Revolution.
You're listening to The Eagle, WLCX, La Crosse's home for Matinee on Air.
Dom Selvia.
Next time, what does former FBI and CIA Director William Webster have to say about Cash Patel and Tulsi Gabbard? Also, our favorite Delano Democrat, Harvey Kay, on the rise of homelessness and political exhaustion. Tune in.
The Dom Selvia Show, weekdays 4 till 6. The Todd Alba Show.
UW System spends $51 million of our taxpayer money for consultants.
three times the budget shortfall that triggered the Oshkosh layoffs in 2023. Why is there such silence from Democrats in the state capitol on this? Ask people in Richland Center, Waukesha, Washington County, if they got their $51 million worth for the UW system.
The Todd Alba Show, weekdays noon till 2 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the app. Local radio for you and your community. It's Civic Media's mission with stations across Wisconsin. Find your favorites at civicmedia.us. Soaring high above La Crosse. This is Eagle 1490 AM WLCX La Crosse. And streaming everywhere on the Civic Media app.
ABC News, I'm Dave Packer. An apology today from Russia's president over the crash of an Azerbaijani Airlines jet in Kazakhstan. ABC's Ines de la Caterra at the foreign desk.
The Kremlin press service now saying Russian President Vladimir Putin has apologized to the president of Azerbaijan for the fact that the tragic incident occurred in Russian airspace, but Putin stopping short of explicitly saying Russia was responsible for the crash.
Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen warning Congress that extraordinary measures are needed as the U.S. could hit its debt limit by mid-January. Yellen asking Congress to either raise or suspend the debt limit. Reports today accusing the Israeli military of forcing patients and staff to evacuate a hospital in northern Gaza. The IDF said it's carrying out an operation in the area of the hospital, calling it a Hamas terror stronghold. Boston officials say crime is at its lowest point in decades in the city. New crime statistics out today show gun incidents were at their lowest since 2011. Homicides the lowest since the 1950s. This is ABC News.